Welcome to the first episode of this new foreign policy podcast. I am Ying Ma, and we will be talking about U.S. support for Ukraine and the divisions within the Republican Party on this issue. I am pleased to be joined by my co-hosts, Steve Bryan and Doug Bandow, and our guest for today, Jacob Heilbrun. Steve Bryan is the author of Weapons and Strategy on Substack, former Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Trade Security Policy in the Reagan administration, and former North America President for Finmeconica, a large multinational defense and technology company that was rebranded some years ago as Leonardo. Hi, Steve.
Hi. We couldn't remember the name Finmeconica, I guess.
Doug Bandow is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, specializing in foreign policy and civil liberties. A prolific foreign policy commentator, he worked as special assistant to President Ronald Reagan. Doug and I are also fellow alumni of Stanford Law School, though we did not attend at the same time. Hi, Doug.
Hello there. How are you doing?
Great. Jacob Heilbrun is the editor of The National Interest, a foreign policy magazine. He is the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons, and author of the forthcoming America Last, The Right's Century-Long Romance with Foreign Dictators. Jacob, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ying.
It's been almost 2 years now since Russia invaded Ukraine. The Senate just passed a bill to provide another $60 billion in aid to Ukraine. Now, I am super excited to talk to you all. In many ways, your disagreements on the Ukraine-Russia war reflect the broader debate on the right, and I look forward to delving into the nuances of your views. Steve, I want to start with you, and I'd like you to react to something that Jacob wrote. In April 2022, Jacob wrote this for Politico, quote, "The more traditional Reaganite wing of the Republican Party sees the Ukraine crisis as a fairly straightforward issue. Putin's invasion threatens the global order. The U.S. has a moral obligation to help enforce the rules and no little self-interest in preventing that order from breaking down," unquote. Steve, you served as a senior defense official in the Reagan administration. Do you count yourself among those who believe the U.S. must uphold the U.S.-led world order and stop Putin from breaking it?
Well, I don't know what a moral order is. Exactly. I mean, we were talking about
world order.
World order, moral order. It's all the same thing. There isn't any. you know, it's Wild West in the real world. But I think the problem of Russia and the potential threat that it may or may not have to the rest of the world is something of concern. You have to accept that. I mean, I accept it. But I think the question is, what's the best way to deal with it, and are we doing the best thing we could be doing at the moment in Ukraine or elsewhere? And I have a lot of doubts about the Ukrainian enterprise. I am not, you know, I studied realpolitik in university when I did my work there. And I've always stayed with that kind of approach to international politics.
All right. Well, we'll get into that a bit more in a little bit. Jacob, let me come to you. You run a magazine that gives voice to the realist approach in foreign policy, and national interests are supposed to be paramount to realism. You know, and I do want to get back to Steve's comment that really is no world order or moral order, but I want to get your thoughts, Jacob. What do you see as America's vital national interests in Ukraine and its war against Russia?
Well, my own views tend to be hawkish on Russia and more dovish on China, which is the reverse of many people in Washington, at least certainly when it comes to China. I see Putin is trying to resurrect not the Soviet, but certainly the Russian Empire, that he would use Ukraine as a jumping off point, either to try and intimidate the Baltic states, Poland, other countries in Eastern Europe, or, you know, potentially he's audacious enough to contemplate and perpetrate a direct attack. So I do see Ukraine as a significant American interest if you think that Europe's fate matters to the United States. Now, you can also argue realism is a pretty broad tent, and it's always a question of what's realistic, what are national interests. You can also argue plausibly that the United States has actually no interest in Europe and should let them fend for themselves. That's just not my view.
Steve, your reaction, do you think that the United States has an interest in the fate of Europe?
Oh, absolutely does. I mean, that's what NATO is all about. We're a member of NATO. And we're bound to that, I mean, by treaty. So it's no, I think we, you know, there are some people who might go further and say we should just be isolationist. But I've never been an isolationist. I don't believe in it. I don't think that's how you survive in today's world. I think the real question boils down to, is Russia a real threat? And is the best way to stop it, if it is a real threat, by the war in Ukraine? Because the other side of the coin is, what happens if Ukraine loses and then Ukraine collapses and the Russians grab it? Then where are we?
Doug, let me come to you. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer recently said on the Senate floor that if some people think that Putin is just going to stop at Ukraine, if they think it's somehow better to reason with him, to appease him, to hear him out, then these moderate Neville Chamberlain. The appetites of autocrats are never ending, unquote. And in fact, to both Doug and Steve, this is an argument that we hear regularly from the proponents of U.S. assistance to Ukraine. And to some extent, we heard it just now from Jacob. And that is that Putin harbors ambitions beyond Ukraine, including in Eastern Europe and the Baltic states. And if he is not stopped at Ukraine, he will be coming for the NATO countries. Why shouldn't America and its allies stop this autocrat now, or more specifically, give money to Ukraine to stop this autocrat?
Well, there are plenty of autocrats who don't run around the world trying to accumulate empires. I think that autocracy itself is really not the issue. You know, it's certainly a reasonable argument. It's a better argument than talking about some kind of world standard. I mean, let's face it, the U.S. writes the rules and then breaks them whenever it feels like, which includes invading other countries. So my view is that the fact that some country does something bad doesn't mean the whole global world order is going to collapse. I just don't see anything in Putin's behavior that suggests he has some vast agenda here of conquest. He's been in power almost a quarter century. So it's a little late to get started to try to kind of pile things up. And what he's managed to do so far, you know, Russia has some extra influence in South Ossetia and Abkhazia, which aren't particularly important. And he's managed to get the Crimea and Donbass, plus some other stuff. And he's bogged down for 2 years in Ukraine. I just don't see this as being the beginning of a blitzkrieg. Especially, I don't see him attacking NATO countries, because it does strike me that he recognizes a difference where you have a treaty commitment of long standing, where you're taking much greater risks than to go after Ukraine. So I don't see Ukraine as a precursor. Strikes me Ukraine is kind of much more likely an end point than a beginning point.
Jacob, Ukraine not as a precursor, and Putin doesn't look like he's beginning some sort of blitzkrieg. Your thoughts on that?
No blitzkrieg, because that was the Nazi form of rapid warfare, the invasion of France, where they just rolled over. I don't see Putin doing that. Until the invasion, the Russian invasion on February 24th, I would have agreed with Doug. I didn't interpret Crimea or even the conflict that he started in the Donbass as signaling that Putin's appetites were that large. But the manner and the rhetoric surrounding the invasion of Ukraine have given me a start, particularly because we're heading close to Hitlerian language and denying that they're the essence of the Ukrainian nation, the kidnapping of the children. This is not just a war of conquest. I mean, he's going further. And then in this interview with Tucker Carlson, referring to Poland 38 times, now maybe, you know, he's just trying to unsettle the Poles. But the direction in which all of this is going has jolted me out of complacency.
Steve, does Putin's language or his rhetoric alarm you? Does that give you any concern that if Putin had his way, he would be coming for Poland or other countries?
Well, no, I think there's two different things here. One's his language and the other's what he might do. They're not necessarily the same thing at all.
Right, right. No, let's.
But if the language is not helpful.
Right. The language let's separate is, those two. So we all saw his so-called history lesson in the Tucker Carlson interview went on and on and on, and my friend Tucker really looked a little annoyed. That kind of language, I guess, something that Jacob refers to as Hitlerian. Does that concern you? And then if it does, do you see Putin having any capability whatsoever to make that kind of language into reality?
Well, it gives him some basis to cause trouble in different countries, in the Baltics, in Poland, you know, that kind of thing. And he may well stir the pot, but there's a lot of difference between politically stirring the pot and sending your army. I mean, these are very different things. And again, anyhow, I don't know what he expects to gain by it. I mean, it's for Russia. I think if the Russians were offered a deal now on Ukraine that they found acceptable, they would jump at it. Because I don't think they want to continue the war if they can find a reasonable solution. And he's already indicated that many times. So that doesn't sound like an aggressor type to me. That he wants to expand the war to Europe or attack Germany or whatever you want to attack. It's not their approach. There was a period in the Soviet time that we had real worry that they might push into West Germany through the Folder Gap. And there was a lot of thinking about it. We were also reading a lot of Russian literature that was focused on that idea. But right now there isn't any literature from the Russian side or Russian think tanks or anything else from the military that really suggests they have any tactical or strategic military aims in Eastern Europe or in the Baltic states. I don't see it. Doesn't mean it won't happen, but certainly there's nothing to indicate it right now.
So Doug, you too worked for the Reagan administration, and you also write regularly for Jacob's magazine, The National Interest. Now, in an opinion piece for the American Conservative last October, you seemed to delineate what was or was not in U.S. national interest. And so you wrote, quote, the U.S. had reason to provide Kiev with modest assistance to help maintain its sovereignty and independence in the face of Russia's initial assault. Washington has no similar cause to underwrite Ukraine's desire to take back lost territory, especially when such objectives appear to be well beyond its ability. Doug, would you elaborate? Are you saying that it would not be in America's interest for all of Ukraine to be gobbled up by Russia, but we won't mind or we won't object if Russia takes and keeps some of Ukraine's territory, whether that be in Crimea, which was taken in the 2014 invasion, or, you know, whether that be territory gained in the current war, if in exchange we get some form of peace settlement?
Well, there are plenty of things I object to, but I don't think we should fight over. So I object to Putin's aggression against Ukraine. It's not, I mean, it's unjustified. I mean, I think there's a whole history there that helps explain it, but it doesn't justify it. So, but that doesn't mean I believe we should, you know, get ourselves into a very lengthy and expensive proxy war that could, you know, escalate in very dangerous ways. And I think that especially means you don't kind of inflate the ambitions of a country that is in real distress, but is suffering the most from the war. And the idea that at least at one point, people talking about Ukraine could win back Crimea and everything else, this struck me as being extraordinarily dangerous. So I would like to see Ukraine survive. And my reaction is that the exact borders matter less to me, though I think the Ukrainians obviously are in the right. You know, Russia should not have attacked them. But my reaction also is the world is a nasty place and bad things happen to countries in bad neighborhoods. And it's not America's job to fix that. So what are our interests? I think that our interests kind of escalate in terms of the survival of an independent Ukraine, which I would hope, you know, could maintain its own existence and find, you know, some kind of a security structure in which, you know, they and Russia can live together. And that's what I'd like to see us aiming for. And then we can, you know, kind of calibrate aid and support to try to pursue that end.
Jacob, why doesn't the Biden administration just encourage Ukraine to enter into negotiations with Russia? In fact, what we've heard or what we've seen in the reporting is that the administration actually has been standing in the way of those negotiations. So why do we want to prolong this conflict?
I don't think we're trying to prolong it. I mean, I think Biden would be quite happy to get a peace agreement before the election. It would cauterize this wound. I mean, the perception is that the world is exploding under Biden's watch, both in the Middle East and in Ukraine. I don't see Biden impeding negotiations. I don't think Putin has any interest in negotiations at this point. And frankly, if I were him, I wouldn't. Because if this package doesn't go through Congress and the Ukrainians are starved of resources, there's no reason that the Russians can't prevail militarily over Ukraine. And maybe be in Kiev by Christmas. So Putin is happy for negotiations on his terms, which he's not going to get. The U.S. can't force Ukraine into negotiations. I think there are feelers. But for right now, I think Putin has the upper hand.
Steve, you've been very critical of the Biden administration, and I think you even wrote that the Biden administration was the party that kind of prevented Ukraine from continuing negotiations with Russia. I believe it was in April of 2022. Why do you think the Biden administration was doing that at that time? And do you agree with Jake that currently the Biden administration would love to see some sort of peace deal?
I don't think they'd love to see a peace deal right now. And they haven't shown any interest in any negotiation at any time at all. They didn't even support the Minsk 1 and Minsk 2 agreements in 2014 and 2015. So they had plenty of opportunity to get behind that or to get behind anything else they wanted to get behind if they were interested. There wasn't any interest by the United States in the deal. I listened very carefully to Naftali Bennett, who was the Israeli prime minister trying to broker a deal between the Ukrainians and the Russians. He also worked with the Germans and with the French. But he ran into a wall when he tried to deal with the United States. The United States essentially said no. So I'm not one of those who thinks that the United States wants a deal. I think the reverse is the case. If we signal to Zelensky tomorrow morning that we would like him to negotiate, I think he would negotiate. whether it would work out, I don't know. I mean, that's another matter. But the fact that there isn't any negotiation, none of this background stuff, but real negotiation doesn't exist.
Why do you think we're not interested in a deal? We meaning the U.S. government.
I think the U.S. thought it was going to win the war. I thought that they thought they could chase the Russians out, humiliate Putin, maybe force his downfall. There was a lot of talk about regime change in Russia. There was probably a lot of action in that regard, too, with the CIA and others. So I think the notion was break the back of Putin and break the Russians. And that was the goal. And the administration has said, look, the same thing as Zelensky has said, Russians have to leave Ukraine 100% out. They must leave. And then we'll have war crime trials and we'll put Putin on trial and all this stuff. No, it's not conducive. It's not how you get a negotiation.
Doug, I think you've written about the interest from Washington in regime change in Moscow, and you've written that it's totally bonkers. I'm curious to just hear more of your thoughts on. I mean, obviously, the war isn't going so well for Ukraine right now, but early on, there were people who harbored those kinds of ambitions. And right now, I think, you know, there is still people who hope that Ukraine would be the ones who could sort of wear down the Russians, or however they would put it now. I'd be curious to hear more about your thoughts on those who wanted regime change early on and you know, and sort of the successor arguments to you know their position on the Ukraine-Russia war.
No, I share Steve's views. It strikes me that there really was a vision that the U.S. could use Ukraine in the war for a larger foreign policy objective, which was to push the Russians back and possibly to remake Russia. I mean, there were some people talking about even Russia breaking up. This could kind of transform the security situation in Eastern Europe. And there was a fair amount of excitement about that. I mean, I've watched some of the webinars, and I didn't see this. You know, the administration people, of course, were much more careful in terms of what they would say. But there certainly was out there among some of the precincts where there's very, very strong advocacy on Ukraine's behalf. I mean, and one problem with that in my mind, it really is kind of using Ukraine for America's purposes. There's nothing unusual about great powers doing that. But Ukrainians are doing an awful lot of dying and an awful lot of their societies being destroyed. So if we start looking at these larger goals, which are harder to obtain, you know, one can imagine them paying a very high price for it. But beyond that, it strikes me that, you know, be very careful what you wish for. I mean, the idea that things couldn't get worse, that, you know, if only Putin goes, that, you know, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison will arise in Moscow and give us a democratic Russia, I think is probably a fantasy. And when these things fall badly, it's the guys with the guns who tend to do well. And there are an awful lot of rabid nationalists in Russia who are worse than Putin. So to start talking about trying to bring down Putin, and especially to bring down the regime, I mean, imagine thousands of, you know, loose nuclear weapons or something. I mean, it just struck me that this was moving into a different plane, where to me, again, the real American objective was you'd like to see a Ukraine survive, a democratic, you know, relatively free state, even if they've lost some territory. That's very different from imagining kind of this grand scheme, which just strikes me very, very dangerous.
What about the risk of escalation? So, Jacob, if by continuing to support Ukraine, we risk an expansion of the war into Europe and nuclear confrontation with Russia, would that not be in our interest?
Well,
do you agree that by continuing to support Ukraine, we're risking such an expansion?
No, not at the moment. The administration actually has come under fire from some pro-Ukraine people in Washington for moving too slowly. I mean, and that's been both from some conservatives and some Ukraine hawks, which they argue that the National Security Council in particular has not tried to create the auspices for Ukrainian victory, which is why Biden's delivery of weaponry to Ukraine was pretty halting. And if you remember in the beginning, Biden offered to evacuate Zelensky and company. So I don't think that the administration has been gung-ho for regime change. And I think it's been very wary of the idea of nuclear escalation. And it has been concerned about upheaval in Russia itself. So I guess I don't quite share the view of Steve on this issue. I think the administration has actually been fairly cautious overall and keeps getting dinged for not being more aggressive in arming Ukraine.
Steve, is the administration being overly cautious?
No. I mean, well, in some categories, yes, but on the whole, no. I mean, we put $100 billion into this war or more. A lot of money. We've emptied our arsenals for this war. So I don't think that's caution. I think that we're throwing whatever we can into the fight with some limitations. I mean, there's some things we didn't want to do. Like we didn't want to provide cluster bombs, but we then provided them. We didn't want to provide longer range missiles, but then we provided them. We didn't want to provide aircraft, but we've allowed the Europeans to provide our aircraft to Ukraine, the F-16s. Having said all that, we don't match very well with Russian capabilities, and that's been a problem for us. I mean, I think it's more practical issue. I understand the people who say if you just throw in more, we're going to win. But I also think, you know, and there is something to be said for this, that you want to be careful about how you escalate this thing because it could spill over into the rest of Europe, something I worried about a lot. Could very well. I mean, the Russians might say, okay, those depots in Poland where they're assembling all the weapons, we'll blow them up. And then you get into a whole other situation as far as Europe is concerned. So I think the administration has been reasonably careful in that regard, but I think they've thrown an awful lot into the mix here. M1 tanks, got the Germans to give the Leopard tanks, HIMARS, which is a terrific system. We've thrown those in. I mean, we've thrown a lot of stuff in. It had some value, but on the whole, the Russians are at the moment regaining some of their lost ground, and it doesn't look like they're going to be dislodged.
Doug, lots of proponents of Ukraine funding also argue that if we don't continue to support Ukraine in its war against Russia, this is going to ultimately embolden Beijing. You spent a lot of time traveling to China, writing about China, studying China. Do you think Beijing is more likely to invade Taiwan if Washington doesn't continue to give money to Zelensky?
I mean, I think the problem here is these are very different circumstances. I don't see aggression as being fungible, nor do I see the response to aggression as being fungible. You know, the question for China is the U.S. prepared to use military force directly? I mean, one could argue that the problem, if you're worried about precedent, then presumably we should be in the war. Because this tells us is that we really don't want to go to war for Ukraine. That's been obvious. That's why we spent 14 years telling them how much we loved them and we'd have them in Ukraine, but refused to bring them in. And we'd bring them into NATO, but refused to bring them in. But the point is we weren't interested in going to war. Well, there's a different relationship and a different view in Washington. I mean, the president has on five occasions said he'd go to war over Taiwan. You know, my reaction is, even though his aides have constantly run that back, you know, if the president says that five times, I believe the president probably would. So I think the Chinese look at this very differently. Indeed, to some degree, if I was from China, I would think it'd be better for the U.S. to be tied down in Europe, you know, ensuring that Russia is going to have a closer relationship with me, that the U.S. is going to be sending money and weapons, you know, kind of into this potentially long-standing conflict. So trying to, you know, see how Beijing would look at that. I think in the end, what Beijing does on Taiwan is going to be very much tied to circumstances in the strait. It's going to be the question of politics there. It's their perception whether Taiwan's moving towards independence, their perception whether we're pushing that along. So I think all these are going to go into a judgment in a way that what we did in Ukraine potentially, you know, years before is just not going to be a major consideration.
And I think there are a lot of China analysts, security analysts, who believe that Beijing has already factored in Washington's involvement if they were to invade Taiwan, and that and so that provides support to your point that it, you know, it's more about what's happening.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Right, rather than what might be happening in, you know, what we might or might not do to fund the Ukraine war effort. Jacob, Doug mentioned that, you know, with all the people talking about how much Ukraine matters in the global war, in the global order, nobody's talking about going to war or putting any troops on the ground. And so if Putin really presents the kind of threat that people think he presents, you know, there's Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and many others talking about how Putin's not going to stop at the Ukrainian border. Should the United States and its allies in Europe be prepared to go to war over Putin's actions?
No.
So in other words, you would want us to continue funding the Ukrainian war effort, but nothing beyond that.
I see no need, and I don't think it would be desirable. That would lead to the kind of escalation that we were talking before. That we do not want to become enmeshed in a direct conflict with Russia. And one of the lessons of the Reagan era, of course, is that using proxy forces can be quite effective. We have not been attacked by Russia. There's no casus belli for us to go to war with Russia.
How much money should we continue to give to Ukraine? And I guess I'm not asking you to put a dollar figure on it, because in Washington, there's a billion here, a trillion there. It all adds up pretty quickly. But what would be considered the metrics for success in terms of our continued funding for Ukraine? Under what circumstances do we say this is going nowhere, we're not giving Ukraine any more money? And under what circumstances do we say this is very good for return for our investment, and we will, you know, we'll keep an eye on either providing more or continuing to cheerlead on the side?
I think it already has been a good investment. I mean, for a relatively low sum, we have essentially demolished a good chunk of the Russian army. And this new tranche of funding, I think, will be critical. If despite this funding, Ukraine were to be routed, I think that would be it. I don't think that there would be any appetite in Washington for investing further in this war. My own gut is that the funding probably would be effective as long as Ukraine itself is capable of fighting, and there is cause for concern over the way that Zelensky is in intervening politically into the military. So none of this is guaranteed, but I do think we should not abandon this fight at this moment.
Doug, I think you've written that you're supportive of humanitarian aid. But are you absolutely opposed to any continuation of military aid?
Well, I think that if we continue, we need to be trending it down, and we need to be thinking about what the end game is and how long we're prepared to do this. And to my mind, that's one of those where I don't think we tell the Ukrainians they have to negotiate, but we make clear to them what we're prepared to finance in the future and what they're looking at, that they cannot expect, you know, the kind of support they've had in the past, that after 2 years, that, you know, this is something that we're not prepared to finance for that kind of a long term. And I think that we have to recognize that, you know, long-term proxy wars are dangerous. And, you know, we fought these before. It's important to recognize the reaction in Washington when people believe that the Russians might have given money to the Taliban to kill Americans in Afghanistan. And that was a period where I don't know, something like, you know, a half dozen Americans had been killed. It wasn't as if there was a lot of fighting going on. It was near the end. But the reaction on Capitol Hill and in Washington was outraged, and we need to do something about that. When that was the death, you know, of a few Americans, well, effectively the U.S., with its support for Ukraine, has killed thousands of Russians. And I think in the danger of escalation is down because the Russians appear to be succeeding. That if it goes the other way, then I think the danger of escalation rises. So to my mind, we don't want to keep an endless proxy war going on. These things themselves create dangers. So I'd like to see us find kind of an exit strategy and work that out with the Ukrainians, that give them some money, and that can include some support beyond just humanitarian, but it needs to be trending down and they need to know where we're going with it.
Mm-hmm. Steve, many of those who are opposed to continued funding for Ukraine rail against the Washington foreign policy establishment. You are actually very much part of that establishment, having served in senior positions overseeing defense and foreign policy in the executive branch and Congress and in the private sector. Many of your liberal internationalist friends and neoconservative friends in the establishment most likely have been surprised by your position on Ukraine. Why have you parted ways with them to join MAGA Republicans, libertarians, and other non-establishment types on opposing in opposing continued funding for Ukraine?
Well, I didn't. Let me set the record straight here. I didn't oppose continued funding for Ukraine. What I've said is that it's a bad enterprise that's going to crash and burn. And if you want to fund it, you have to understand that that's where it's going.
Sound like a ringing endorsement of funding.
Well, it's not a ringing. No, it's not intended to be an endorsement. It's intended to say that we used to say throwing good money after bad. I mean, it's not going to achieve its objectives for many empirical reasons. Let me give you a few. I mean, one is that there's all this money, but there aren't any weapons. Where are you going to get them? We've emptied a lot of the warehouses that we have with supplies that were meant for our own national security, and we've sent it to Ukraine. Ammunition, we're almost out of ammunition. We're trying to produce more, but we're way behind the power curve on that. In more sophisticated weapons, even things like Stingers, you know, we will make them in the next few years, but not until. So we're really in some trouble. If we're in trouble, if you look at NATO, it's even in deeper trouble because they're practically out of business from a military point of view. I think that's very dangerous. And I think that what hasn't been calculated into the equation is the danger that this causes to the whole architecture of security that we've laboriously built since the end of World War II. I mean, I think we're putting too many eggs in one basket, and we're risking our own security and the security of our friends abroad for an enterprise that looks like it's going to fail. That's my position.
So this is you see this as a bad enterprise. You're not voicing opposition to it, but you're pointing out why this is a bad enterprise. What would you propose instead?
Make a deal with the Russians. I mean, that's the easy way out. It's not easy, but it's a way out. Anyway, you're going to have to make a deal with the Russians either today, tomorrow, or next year. I mean, sooner or later, you're going to make a deal with the Russians. The idea that Washington has entertained that we're going to push the Russians out of Ukraine, it's not going to happen. Simply won't happen. The idea that somehow the Russians are going to change direction and they'll get a new government, that doesn't look very promising either. So I think there aren't very many options here, but one of them is to try and negotiate a deal, a security deal with the Russians, which we barely need.
Jacob, let me come to you. Am I correct that you consider yourself a realist?
Looks like Jacob is off.
Oh, all right. Never mind. So, Doug, I'll come to you while Jacob is trying to get back on. You're a libertarian and you work for a premier libertarian think tank. These days, plenty of libertarians, including Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, like to call themselves realists, and others are big on other libertarians are big on advocating for restraint and foreign policy. But on the Ukraine issue, you guys find yourself in the company of former President Trump, former presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy, Tucker Carlson, as well as folks like Steve and, you know, and realist scholars like John Mearsheimer. And now, even though you guys may have all come to the same policy prescription, which is no, you know, unconditional aid for Ukraine, your starting point and rationales are obviously different. And you know, and libertarians represent a very important contingent on the right. What animates libertarians on this issue differently than the MAGA Republicans or maybe the more traditional hawkish security types?
Well, I think the MAGA Republicans tend to be in many ways much more Jacksonians, unilateral interventionists. So they want to intervene if they think it's really in America's interest. They want to do it unilaterally. You know, they're not unwilling to use military force. You know, I think that libertarians, broadly speaking, I mean, obviously there are differences among them, tend to be a bit more emphasis on peace, that our view is the cost of intervention itself is too high, that the ends sought generally don't warrant that intervention. We tend to put a pretty high premium on avoiding the unintended consequences. I mean, a World War I where everybody thinks it's going to be nice and short, and then 4 years later, 20 million people are dead, and a generation later, you're led into another conflict. That we tend to, I think, lean against war and be more skeptical of abstract state interests, more concerned about some of the human costs. Libertarians, frankly, there aren't an awful lot of libertarians around. We're pretty small as a group, so we work with whoever we can. We work with people on the left on civil liberties and other issues. So I'm quite willing to work with folks on the right, even if we disagree on other issues, if it comes to an issue like Ukraine.
Jacob, I started asking you a question, but I think you might have gotten disconnected. A similar question for you regarding where you stand on the foreign policy spectrum. I think it's safe to say that, you represent a realist magazine, but your gung-ho support for Ukraine aid departs somewhat from the positions held by other prominent realists, including scholars like John Mearsheimer. Why do you see Ukraine differently compared to them? And what is it that you think some of your fellow realists are missing?
I think, realism is everyone claims to be a realist. Even the neocons think of themselves as realists.
So, do they think of themselves as realists?
You ask Robert Kagan, he would tell you he's interested in power and, it depends how narrowly you want to define the term realism in national interests. There are different schools within the realist camp, I think. I'm not saying that the neocons are realists. I don't think they are. The reason that I come down differently, I think, is because I think that Doug was absolutely right, that we don't go after every autocrat in the world. That's insanity if you take that approach. In this case, Putin, to me, and there's obviously wide room for disagreement on this, is starting to look more like one of those leaders who wants to overthrow the chessboard, and they don't come along that often. I don't think Stalin wanted to overthrow the chessboard. I think he was more of a realist. I think Hitler, then you get into the megalomaniacs like Napoleon and Hitler. And unfortunately, Putin is starting to look to me more in that camp where he is ready to go further than people expected. I mean, the invasion of Ukraine was really pushing the envelope. And again, as I said earlier, the language he uses, the hypertrophy language about Russian history, the history lesson that he delivered to Tucker Carlson, these 40, 50 page treatises that he produces, his claims that it's all in the archives, now his claim that Poland had it coming in World War II. I mean, this is not normal language. So my alarm bells start to go off when it comes to Vladimir Putin. I don't sense that he's simply a conventional leader of an autocracy anymore.
And so we go back to what we discussed earlier about rhetoric versus capability. So even if his rhetoric is alarming, do you see any sign of him being even remotely capable of realizing his ambitions when it comes to his ambitions for territory beyond Russia's borders?
Not at the moment. And he has put the Europeans on high alert. If you look at the statements, even coming out of Germany, he's talking about needing to be prepared for an attack from Russia within 5 years. So, you know, his language and could have the perverse result from his perspective of creating a more unified and powerful European Union. Timothy Garton-Ash is even talking, had a piece in The Guardian talking about building a European defense force. That's something that was talked about in the 1950s and never went anywhere. The Europeans, obviously, are going to have to start doing a lot more for themselves and are not going to be able to rely on the United States to the extent that they did in the past.
Yeah. So we're coming to the end of this discussion, and I do want to bring up the question of Iraq, because I think that the legacy of George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq, I think, has had a major impact on the thinking of a lot of people, including, I think, many of the MAGA Republicans. And so I want to quote from a very long tweet that Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio sent out, I think it was a month or two ago. And he said, quote, "The same idiots who pushed the most aggressive posture in Ukraine did the same in Iraq," and unquote. And then he refers to the bizarre and reflexive World War II analogies. You know, he also talks about the belief that that tough talk and suicidal depletion of resources is somehow an effective deterrent against Russia. He refers to mission creep, something that Steve and Doug both talked about, and then additionally the fact that our policies are uniting our adversaries together, Iraq, Iran, and then Russia and China. And so that was from his very long tweet. And I think he is one of the more thoughtful MAGA Republicans opposing continued funding for Ukraine in this war. And I want to sort of just get a response from all three of you on just how much the legacy of Iraq affects America's posture toward the world. You know, is it possible that in the near future, whatever intervention we have overseas, even whether they are in our interests or not, that we will sort of be hobbled by the disaster that happened in Iraq, and that somehow, you know, that there will somehow be a lot of very thoughtful people who would be hesitant to put any money into those kinds of enterprises, and not to mention, you know, putting any American lives at risk. So let me start with Steve, and then I'll make my way to Jacob and Doug on this question.
Well, Iraq is a very complicated story. You know that. I think that the real issue right now with Iraq is that it's caught between the United States on the one hand and the Iranians on the other, with the Iranians in the dominant position, unfortunately. And it's all part of what the Iranians are trying to achieve in the Middle East, which is to dominate that whole region from Iraq, from Lebanon to Syria, and eventually to be able to make war on Israel with that advantage. That's pretty clear. The problem we have is that we have very small presence in Iraq at three bases, really. And they're kind of hostage to the Shiite Islamists who are aligned with the Iranians. And that's where the trouble comes from for right now. Well, no, I'm not getting into the long history.
What I was asking about was that we went into Iraq with George W. Bush promising a democratic revolution in the Middle East. And so, Steve, what you just described, that is far from.
There's no well, you know, they still have a parliament and they still elect people, but they elect the wrong people. There's always that little detail. So if they'd elect the right people, we might be happy.
But how much do you think Iraq affects the calculation of others on the right, whether they be conservatives, libertarians, you know, sort of non-establishment types, whoever they are, that people who might otherwise be more supportive of America's involvement overseas are now likely to be far less so because of our experience in Iraq?
The British historian A.J.P. Taylor said that the lesson of history is that there is no lesson of history. I think that a lot of so-called realists on the right have become entranced by Iraq, which was a delusional and disastrous war in which the United States directly marched in and toppled Saddam Hussein, and that this would be the beginning of a domino effect in the Middle East, that freedom would flourish in the region. It was hallucinatory. I don't think that the Ukraine conflict bears any resemblance to this. Here is actually the reverse. We are aiding a country that's been attacked, and if we provide sufficient aid to Ukraine, it's the Russians who will learn the same lesson that we learned in Iraq. The Russians here are the aggressor. They are facing a determined adversary. This is an imbroglio for the Russians, who are losing enormous numbers of troops and military hardware. They can only win if we give up.
Dub, is this an opportunity for us to help Russia, sort of help Russia see the same legacy, that a similar legacy that the United States saw in Iraq?
Well, it strikes me that Iraq should hobble us in the sense that it shows the dangers of people who come up with fantastically unrealistic expectations and are able to push them through. I mean, anyone who lived through the Iraq era who opposed the administration felt the lash of the administration. I had conservative publications that stopped running any of my columns because I, you know, opposed the war. So I think it offers an important lesson, but I would agree with Jacob that, I mean, the argument that he makes in terms of Putin is a very serious one. I treat that very differently than when I listened to Wesley Clark, who was prepared to start World War III back, you know, with Kosovo and the Balkans. You know, there are people who talk about, you know, again, breaking up Russia, et cetera. Those are the people, it strikes me, this is the delusional Iraq sense. I would love to see the Russians chastened, and I think that they will be. They won't admit it, at least Putin won't admit it. I have to believe that, in fact, he has been at the loss of blood. The question is still, is it in our interest to proceed? And if so, exactly how? And then I think, you know, we need to make an argument on that. You can't just wave Iraq and say any intervention that anyone proposes is another Iraq. It isn't. But it is worthwhile to remembering how much of the political establishment went forward, people talking about cakewalks, and the expectations of the follow-on effects that were going to be so positive. You know, none of that occurred. And what we've got has been a real tragedy of hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis dying. And that's the one thing I might point out with Ukraine is, I think the chief suffering are the Ukrainians. And they are entitled to fight the war any way they want, but I worry that if we are encouraging them to to fight a war that they seem very likely to lose, that suffering is going to be far greater, and that we should take that into account with our own policy.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. Any last words from any of you before we conclude?
Ying, I admire your restraint in conducting this conversation.
You should add your quota of what you actually think.
Well, I'm not always known for my restraint, and I assure you in future episodes that will come out. I want to thank my co-host Doug Bandow, the Cato Institute, and Steve Bryan, a former senior Defense Department official who now writes for Substack. Our guest today is Jacob Heilbrun of the National Interest. Steve, Doug, and Jacob, thank you for sharing your views and your expertise, and it's been great fun chatting with all three of you.
Enjoy.
Thank you.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in to this first episode of our new foreign policy podcast. Please share widely, and we look forward to bringing the public many more thoughtful and provocative conversations in the future.